Okay, so since I'm still horribly jet lagged and I didn't sleep last night, I changed the title yet again. And the direct result of this was that I was trying to calculate how much tip I should pay this morning from $16, and I came up with 20% of that being 5, and then I added that to the 16, and I ended up with 18, which is actually the right amount. So just so you know how it's going to go. So I'm going to talk about quantifying spin transfer torques in MgO-based magnetic tunnel junctions, or unofficially, why it's such a pain to quantify anything properly in these devices. So the original idea behind this experiment was that we were trying to consider ways of how we could possibly measure some torques induced by thermal gradients in these things. But since we're unsure if these torques are large enough to actually induce any reasonable or measurable effect, then we were considering at some point, just having a proper current going through, characterizing the torques we get from the current to depth, and then adding a thermal gradient on top and see what happens. So we never made it to the thermal gradient in these samples, and you'll see why. So I won't give you much introduction because Yaroslav said there's no need. So if you take the most general case where you have a tunnel junction which has one reference layer which serves as a polarizer, and then you have a free layer on top, and both are magnetized in plane, then you can describe the dynamics of such a structure under the influence of an applied current or a voltage by this generalized or Landau-Lischitz-Gilbert equation, which includes two additional spin torque terms. Now, this one here is written as a double vectorial product, as everybody knows, and because it's a double vectorial product between M and essentially the direction of this other layer, which we consider as setting the direction of the polarization of the incoming electrons. So because this is a double product, it lies in the plane defined by these two vectors, and so it's called in-plane spin torque or damping-like spin torque, at least for this particular configuration. Because it has the same, so it goes on the same direction as the damping. The other one is called perpendicular spin torque because it's a simple vectorial product, and it also behaves like a field, and therefore it's called field-like torque. In the most general case, because we don't want to put any assumptions, we are trying to quantify these two torques in MgO-based tunnel junctions, so we didn't want to start off by making assumptions, so we just put some coefficients here or some functions which are these T perpendicular, no, sorry, T parallel and T perpendicular, which give you the bias dependence. Generally in a TMR, in a metallic sample, you can essentially neglect this because it's something like less than 5% of the magnitude of the other. And this one, so for the coefficient of the in-plane torque, we know that this is proportional to the applied current and the angle, and it depends in a non-trivial fashion on the angle between these two vectors. For a tunnel junction, it has been predicted that this is these two terms, and also there are some experimental results showing that these two terms have similar orders of magnitude, so we have to consider this other term, and also we know that they depend on the applied voltage. Now, that's where it gets complicated. So the exact fashion in which they depend on the applied voltage, it's somewhat unclear, so it can depend on many things. I'm not listing, there's been lots of papers in the meantime on these things. I'm not trying to make a full bibliography research, but just even from the beginning, we knew that, for example, in John's paper, we can have any bias dependence of these torquants, which goes from linear, constant, to parabolic, depending on all sorts of parameters in the structure. So, because I'm not going to explain the theory papers that you are writing to you, I'm just going to tell you how we are trying to measure these things and somewhat miserably fail. Okay, so the first method is the so-called spin torque FMR or ST-FMR. I'm just going to introduce this method, and I'm not going to talk about it ever again because we are still analyzing the data. The second method is the so-called thermally excited FMR. And finally, we have some papers which have attempted to get this spin torque bias dependence from voltage versus field switching phase diagrams. So spin torque FMR, so these are mainly, at least we have in this particular case for MGO-based magnetic tunnel junctions, we actually have two groups which somewhat get similar results experimentally on similar structures, which is good. And also, this is the only example where this happened. So, okay, so the way you make this experiment, how do you measure it? So you take your tunnel junction and, I was trying to be fancy, but it makes no sense. So you take a tunnel junction and you apply an AC current through your sample. Now, if you induce precession and you obey certain rules of symmetry of the precession trajectory, then you have this. This is your incoming current, and as you excite resonantly precession in the free layer, then the magnetization of the free layer is moving along some trajectory. And this produces, via the TMR, it produces an AC signal, so an AC resistance, because the angle between the reference layer and the free layer is periodically changing. Now, if you multiply an AC current with an AC resistance, you end up with a signal that looks something like this, which will give you eventually an average DC component. So this is what you measure in spin torque FMR experiments. Now, the in-plane spin torque term, or in this paper, so they called it a spin torque term, and then the other torque was called the effective field-like torque. So the two spin torque terms have different symmetries as you plot this versus frequency. So if you decompose your output signal as a function of frequency in these two terms, you can actually separate the field-like torque and the damping-like torque from the output signal. And you can also show that this output signal is going to change symmetry and all sorts of other things if you, in addition to the AC current, you apply a DC bias. And if you look at how this changes then with a DC bias, you can estimate the bias dependence of this damping-like torque and the field-like torque. OK, the other thing is what we were trying to do when we were in Japan. This is called the thermally excited FMR measurement. So this is a really easy experiment. So what you essentially do is you take your tunnel junction and you put a current through. And you apply the current so that both the current and the applied field favor the same state. So you know that you cannot possibly drive dynamics, I mean spin torque driven dynamics, in this configuration, and you stay in the linear regime. And then, because these layers are really, the free layers are really thin and really small, they are very sensitive to thermal excitations. And you can, and because you also have a very large TMR ratio, you can actually detect the magnetization being kicked around the local field by this thermal energy. So if you apply the, so essentially in this experiment, you're only using the current as a way to probe the state of your sample. So what you do is that you put your DC current through. This thing is just being kicked around by thermal energy. And then if it's moving on some trajectory, you will get an AC output voltage out of this. Now, you can also get the bias dependence if you analyze how these AC output voltages change as you change the bias applied through the sample. The damping-like torque is going to change the line width of your signal. So it has been shown that you can write the line width as you can see here. And essentially here you have this additional term which gives you the bias dependence of the in-plane torque. When you don't have any applied bias, which in experiment it never happens because you don't measure anything, what you measure is TMR essentially. But if you extrapolate the dependence of delta F on the applied voltage to zero, you should end up with this term here, which in principle should give you the intrinsic damping of your sample. Now, the field-like torque, because it behaves like a field, it only changes the frequency of your output signal. So then if you analyze how the frequency of this output signal changes again when you apply bias through this sample, you can also determine the bias dependence of this term here, which is the field light torque. And in principle, you should also be able to extrapolate data and measure not really the saturation magnetization, but at least the effective magnetization in your sample from the same data. Okay, so the third thing, maybe Kyung-jin knows better than me, so I'm not going to try to explain this in too much detail. But the third thing, I mean, this is just data that I measured on a random tunnel junction, is just to plot the switching voltages as a function of the applied field. So what you do is you take your tunnel junction, you apply a voltage, and hopefully you can put enough voltage without killing your sample to actually observe spin transfer induced switching. Now you can measure this switching so-called on pulse, which means that as you put the current through or the voltage through the sample, you're also monitoring the state of your sample, which means that you're going to see this type of curve where you see that here, for example, the sample is in AP state. And the AP state, of course, has a very strong bias dependence. The resistance of the AP state has a very strong bias dependence, which is why you get this additional curvature on top here. This becomes sometimes difficult if you want to plot a phase diagram, depending on how you want to do it. It may be difficult to deal with additional curvatures because of just the way you plot the data. So you can also look at this phase diagram on the so-called off-pulse measurement, where what you do is you start off in a given state, say in a parallel state. Then you send the pulse with a given magnitude, say, I don't know, 0.2 milliamp. You set the current back to zero, and then you monitor, you check again the state of your sample with a very low applied bias. Now you can get something like this. So this is actually an example for Kyung-jin's paper. So you get these points here, which are essentially give you the where the switching events have occurred. So and in this case, you can see this plotted for two different temperatures, so at room temperature and at 4.2 Kelvin. So what this phase diagram tells you is that the anti-parallel state is stable, say at room temperature, is stable above this red line here. The parallel state is stable below this line here. In between, you have both of them stable, and somewhere here and there, you should get precession. Now, you can see that as you go to low temperature, you, of course, you know, your switching phase diagram changes because switching both in field and in current are thermally activated, or at least partially thermally activated, in particular when you do these experiments with long pulses like DC currents or milliseconds or whatever. Now, if you want to actually extract the bias dependence from such plots, you need to have some formula for how the switching voltage depends on the applied field or vice versa. And you need to assume some thermal activation model in your fit because you still have some real temperature in there and so on and so forth. Now, this thermal activation model induces additional parameters, of course, in your fit. And in some cases, this can be a problem because we already start off with a bunch of parameters which we don't know for this sample. So we know the nominal size of the free layer, but we never actually know the real size. We know what the MS is generally in a thin film, but we don't know what the effective magnetization is when you pattern it into a 100 nanometer sized sample. And the same applies for the damping. So, I mean, we can estimate an effective damping from the line widths close to zero current, but this is not necessarily the intrinsic damping. It can be also related to things like inhomogeneous broadening and so on. So, generally, you would try to limit as much as possible the numbers of parameters you need for your fit, because otherwise, if you have five parameters, you can fit an elephant, so it doesn't mean anything at the end. So, okay. So we had these samples, actually. So even before I got there, they had some samples from a PhD student that I inherited, had some samples from Jonathan's son, that somehow got to Dresden via at least two other different people. So, and the samples look like this. So, okay, this is the free layer, which was a cobalt iron boron 1 nanometer iron 0.5 nanometer layer. Then we have the very thin MgO tunnel barrier, and then we have the reference layer in here. We have this convention for positive current, meaning that the current goes from top to bottom, so the electrons go from bottom to top. And the positive field is applied in this direction, which means that it favors parallel state. And this is some estimation for the size of the sample, but keep in mind that we don't really know what the size of the sample is. Hello. First thing you do, of course, you try to characterize your sample the easiest way. First of all, check if it's dead. So you measure the TMR curve, easy in DC TMR curve. You see you have a TMR signal. It looks more or less as you expected. However, the coercivity is really, really low. This may be related to the fact that these layers are very thin and also very soft. However, this is the coercivity we get or the, at room temperature. You can also characterize the bias dependence of the resistance of the sample in the two states. And this is useful because then you can, depending on what kind of measurements you do, you can convert currents into voltages and so forth. OK, so we start off. So I said the spin torque FMR data, I will not discuss it here. So we start off with thermally excited FMR. So we take this sample, and as I said, we apply a DC current through this sample. We make sure that the current and the field that are applied favor the same state, so we cannot drive precession in this configuration. And then we monitor the output signal on a spectrum analyzer, which essentially just gives you the frequency, the voltages as function of the frequency. And we do this for different values of the applied current. Don't try to strain your eyes to read this because it's just an example. So this is a curve measure with current and field favor, a set of curves, with current and fields favoring the antiparallel state. And this is a set of curves measured for current and field favoring the parallel state for increasing, bias from top to bottom. So these have been shifted, obviously, vertically, just for clarity.
So you actually have three magnetic transforms in the sample.
Yes.
So when you say anti-parallel, it means two poles are parallel.
Right. So so your signal, because again, what you're measuring is TMR. So between the two top layers, you have an MgO layer, which means that you're going to have a large TMR. Between the two bottom layers, you have a metallic layer. So you can, if you want, you can also measure stuff with respect to what the bottom layer is doing. But in this case, you get almost no signal from it. In GMR samples, you see.
So the bottom layer is always the same. So you can, the magnetization is always the same
direction. That too. So it's possible. So if you go to large applied fields, you start to cant this. And you know it's a SAF. It's a synthetic antiferromagnet. So then it starts rotating, and it does all sorts of things. But and I mean, you can even see it on the. So here, for example, you can see that the resistance of the sample starts to decrease as you increase the field. This is because the bottom layer starts to rotate. I mean, in the following, so we are essentially concentrating on this field range over here. And these fields are so far below anything that has an impact on exchange bias, synthetic antiferromagnetic layer, that you don't really need to worry about.
So you would be actually in a situation where the two are parallel but anti-parallel to the bottom one. Right?
Okay, so the two bottom ones, which make the SAF.
Why don't we go to the next slide because then
you can play it. Yeah. Okay, so these two layers are very strongly coupled. So in this field range that we are looking at, they always want to stay antiparallel. In addition, this is pinned with an antiferromagnet. So when we talk about parallel and antiparallel, we only talk about the relative orientation of this thing and this thing. But you can actually, there are situations where you can measure signals from the other one as well. Okay, so...
Is there any reason actually for these, for having this set? I mean,
it's just to make sure that you can, you don't rotate the reference layer as well on a reasonable range of fields. So it's just to make it more stiff, essentially.
It also minimizes the fringing fields on the freeway.
Well, statically. Okay, so the first thing you see is that in these two configurations, as you increase the bias, this thing blue shifts, which means is shifting towards higher frequencies, and this thing red shifts, which means it's shifting to lower frequencies. If you increase the current through a device, whatever your device is, you have Joule heating. If you have Joule heating, you can always have effects like you're reducing the effective magnetization, the coercivity, the whatever. So this would give you a reduce in frequency. You can always explain a red shift in terms of heating of the sample. Explaining a blue shift would actually imply that you are cooling the sample with your bias, which becomes more counterintuitive.
Can you change ambient temperature?
Yes. Okay, so you can change ambient temperature, and we are going into low temperature measurements, not for this thing, but for these phase diagrams and real-time switching. But every time, okay, so this means you have to put your... So this in this case, the way we do these measurements at room temperature is that we just make a mechanical contact and we minimize all the lengths of the cables involved and the number of connectors and everything that gives you losses in these things. Now, if you want to put it, like, for example, if you go to low temperature, you have to have some, you have to put your sample in some kind of closed space, and you need to have additional connectors. So, I mean, yeah, you need to worry about whether or not you're still detecting anything. So, I mean, okay.
But you can do that,
no? We can do this, but, yeah. So we started doing it.
In principle, if you cool it down, then all these heating effects perhaps might become less important.
So okay, there are some arguments for which, I mean, we can talk about it later if you want. You can show that actually these heating effects are not important in this configuration because you can just change the sense of the current while staying in the same sense and in the same. Okay, Peltier effect is dependent on current polarity, right? So. If you're saying, okay, I'm cooling it in, so I to explain a cooling, I would have to swap the direction of the current, right? But you can show that if you stay in the same state and you put a positive current or a negative current, as long as you're still in the linear regime, the frequencies are exactly the same. So they are, in the antiparallel case, they blue shift in both cases, so that you cannot explain with things like Peltier effects.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that it's nice to have an additional control size that you can independently kind of check all these assumptions so directly if you could change ambient temperature.
Yeah, I guess.
Would be helpful.
I think compared to all the other fitting parameters we stick in there, temperature is really not the biggest problem. Not at this point. I mean, you'll see how it gets. Okay, so. Yeah, I won't discuss in detail how we have to do a lot of data analysis out of. So we see what you essentially measure is a frequency as function of the applied field and applied bias and a line width, so the width delta F of your peak. This is what you get experimentally. Now, if you want to convert this into torque and a torque bias dependence, you have to do a lot of data analysis to get you anywhere. And so. Essentially, your signal comes from some FMR term plus this parallel torque, which, as I said, is damping-like and changes the line width, and this perpendicular torque, which is a field-like torque, so it changes the frequency. So if you plot the frequency versus the applied field or versus the applied bias, what you extract from this is the torque in the unit of a field, which you know as a function of the applied bias. But the units you have are field. What you're measuring is a field. I mean, okay, you're measuring a frequency which you're converting in a field. You get two, and the same thing for the line width. So you essentially get two things in field units. which depends on the applied bias, but also depend on the effective magnetization you consider and the magnetic volume of your sample. So if you then plot this, you get this. So these are the field units. This is what you extract directly from the measurement. So this is this field unit torque for the parallel torque, so the in-plane torque, and as a function of the applied voltage. And this is the perpendicular torque or the field-like torque as a function of the applied voltage. So this comes directly from the experiment. So you can fit this with a straight line, and you can fit this with a parabola, or if you're feeling really adventurous, you can also fit it with two broken straight lines. And then, of course, you're trying to compare this to anything that has been published in the literature. And to compare this, so we end up with field units, right? So what you measure in spin torque FMR is the so-called torquent, which is this coefficient over here, essentially. And so in order to convert these two, we have to make some assumption about the effective magnetization and the volume of the sample. So we assume the volume of the sample is something that is what has been written in lithography or measured in SEM after lithography. The MS, we try to extract it directly from the data. In addition, there are other things like the damping factor and so on and so forth, which we don't know in the samples, but we can try again to estimate it from the data. So, okay, so now if we assume, so you've seen that the coercivities and for the samples and the external fields we're applying, these are considerably lower than the saturation magnetization, or what we think is the saturation magnetization, or at least the order of magnitude of the saturation magnetization in this type of materials. So you can say, okay, if I extrapolate this to zero voltage and I get rid of this term here, then essentially this, I can neglect these fields with respect to DMS. And then I'm left with something which depends on the external field and coercivity. Okay, we neglect the coercivity as well because it's almost nothing. And we just take, we plot the frequency as a function of the square root of the external field, and the slope of this thing should be the effective magnetization. And this is the effective magnetization that we use when we convert these field units into torquents. So we can do this in the antiparallel state and the parallel state. Now, remember, so the assumption is that the external field is much, or at least, okay, the coercivity on the anisotropy is much smaller than the external field. So it's unsurprising that at some point when you go to really low fields, this you cannot use this relation anymore. But so we take this for this field range. We take essentially this last point over here where you have a linear dependence, and we say, okay, this gives me the slope, and this gives me the effective magnetization. If I do this, then I get 0.25 Tesla for, I mean, okay, this is mu zero and effective in the parallel state, and 0.29 in the end, the other way around. So 0.25 in the antiparallel state and 0.29 in the parallel state. This is a really low value. However, these are really thin layers, and we know that there's a perpendicular anisotropy component in these materials when they are so thin. So you can say, okay, maybe I just have randomly some really large perpendicular anisotropy component. And then you can say, okay, so this is the effective magnetization once again. You generally expect the state to be somewhat, so the state of the sample, which we assume is single domain, is actually not single domain. So the local magnetization configuration can be more or less homogeneous depending on how the free layer is pointing with regards to the reference layer.
Do you have thin film data?
No, not from this one. But we don't even need the thin film data. You will see why.
If I think in the Gaussian units, that's the same as for pi mass. This is like Tesla. Is it
Don't do this to me after. It's for pi MS if you want. Okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be.
So it's mu zero MS.
Huge. So it's you say small, so it's plus 4 pi.
Okay, so for example, for, I don't know, for cobalt iron, you expect something like 1.82, whatever, depending on composition. Okay, so we assume we know these values, and then we take our data in terms of line widths as a function of voltage and the frequency as a function of voltage, and we extrapolate. If we extrapolate this in zero voltage, you can estimate the effective damping from the line widths extrapolated into zero bias, where this, in a macro spin model, this the damping would give you the line widths. And you can also, if you plot the frequency, you can also estimate the average coupling fields in the sample. So what we get is 0.08 in the anti-parallel state and 0.04 in the parallel state. So again, you see that these values are different, just like the saturation magnetization are different. This can also be explained by the fact that you have some inhomogeneous line broadening in the sample. But just, you know, just for the hell of it, to make sure, you go to higher fields where you know the sample is saturated. And if you do that, so before we were looking at some point over here, if you now go to higher fields where the signals become much smaller, but nevertheless we can still do it if we apply a large enough bias, and we take just this tail end of the data at even larger fields, we end up with a MS value of 1 tesla and an alpha of 0.01, which is what has been measured and what has been reported in for such films from fMR data. So this is comparable to the thin film data. So this already tells you that when you go to these really low fields that you need to apply in order to actually get a measurable signal from these samples to try to analyze anything whatsoever, your sample is not going to be in a very homogeneous state. And this explains both why the damping is increasing when we just take the lower field, no applied field data, and why the effective magnetization is also decreasing.
What was the values for the low field damping?
The 0.04 and 0.0. I mean, you see the spread, yeah. And also, I mean, okay, so for the peak position, I don't even want to talk about it because it looks like waves on the sea. Okay, so now we have a problem because, again, we can measure these things in terms of fields as a function of the applied bias, but converting it into any unit that might be interesting for you becomes really dependent on the assumptions you're putting in. And which field range? Yeah.
Question on this slide. So are you assuming here that the prefact the torquens is angle independent? In a way, you're assuming that this is the form of the torques.
Yeah, but in this case it doesn't. Okay, this is already for the phase diagrams or for the next one?
So my question is, can you actually address that issue and maybe allow for angle?
We can also put this in the calculations, and we can also consider this, but in spin torque, I mean, the spin torque FMR measurements, for example, that the Cornell guys did pretty much show that there's no angle dependence, at least for the electric.
So that's torque. Another fact, that the angle dependence is just negligible.
Yeah. Although, I mean, for thermal torque, there should be something, so we had this idea that maybe we can distinguish the two by looking at angular dependence or something else, but yeah, this doesn't work either, so you'll see what. So, this was what we can get out of the thermally excited FMR data. In principle, if we would go to samples with either thicker free layers or harder free layers, we would get more reliable information. But as it is, for this such small magnetic volumes and such soft materials, this is all you can experimentally say without drinking two bottles of wine before and getting too enthusiastic. So I'm going to talk about how you can try to estimate this bias dependence from the phase diagrams. So remember, in a phase diagram, you measure your switching events I mean, as a function of applied field and current. So if you try to fit this with something, you need a formula to fit them with. So so far, we know the switching currents for analytically for which have been calculated for metallic samples, and I mean, of course, you can convert this into a voltage if you really want to. But remember that for a metallic sample, this term is negligible. So first question we were thinking is, what does this thing do when I put it in the equation? How does this change my switching currents and fields? So here I'm only going to show the calculation where you take this. So we assume now that the in-plane spin torque is linear on V and has no angular dependence. And the field-like torque is quadratic on V. But we also ran calculations with including an additional linear term for this thing, letting this be. So if you assume this is quadratic in V as it's written here, you essentially assume that the perpendicular spin torque term always favors the antiparallel state, regardless of the polarity of the voltage. This is what experiments have shown and what a bunch of you have calculated, so I don't want to contradict you too much. But as I said, we also included other configurations just to see what happens to the thing. So we have these plots somewhere. So, so
it is considerable also the sign of that torque.
Yeah, we also changed the sign.
So could be parallel on and parallel.
Yeah, that is also you can. This is no. Once you do it, it's
correct. Essentially, this is essentially like non-equilibrium contribution to the Kolmogorov-Weinberg interaction that could also change sign.
Yeah, we don't care how you change the sign. We just look at what happens to the switching voltage. This is
anti-parallel.
Yeah, this is if you write it like this, you assume it favors anti-parallel state. But you can also change if I change the sign here, then it favors the parallel state. And I can also introduce another variable here which just changes the sign, right?
But experimentally you say it's always positive.
Okay. So we write it like this because there are two experimental results from spin torque FMR and a bunch of theoretical papers which agree with each other. This is the rest. I mean, there are theories which agree with one experiment and theories which agree with another experiment. There's a whole variety of measurements that have been done. But this is the we took this case here because this is the one that you can say, okay, it was independently confirmed. But we also calculated this thing for other cases. As in the phase diagram, not the torque. We don't calculate torques, we just calculate phase diagrams. Okay?
So it's always positive.
Here in what I talk next is positive, but I can also show you the phase diagrams calculated with negative. Let me go further and then you'll see. Okay. Okay. So now we put. I mean, we say that essentially this is a in-plane magnetized field. This is lying in the plane of the layers, and this has an easy axis, which is along the direction of the reference length. And then we calculate these critical voltages like has been done before for the metallic junctions, but now taking into account this additional field-like term. So this is the only thing that's new here with regards to what Julie Grolier has done, and also that there's no angular dependence, but we can also include an angular dependence, just, you know. We as theorists, as experimentalists, have to calculate it 5 times. Personally, I have to calculate this thing 5 times before I get 2 results that agree with each other. So, you know, if I add more terms in the stuff, I mean, I'm not going to do anything else for the next 3 years. So, okay. So you essentially linearize this equation, and you don't need to look at this too much. This was for the students. So, what you're doing is essentially you assume that the free layer is either parallel or anti-parallel to the reference layer, and you look at when this state starts to become unstable, which doesn't mean that it switches. I mean, it could go to a precession state, or it could go perpendicular or something if it really wants to. But you just know that it goes away from this state, okay? This is all you calculate in this. And if you do that, then you end up with this. This is the phase, this is what we calculate. Okay? So I can show you this plot now for all sorts of assumptions with regard to what is the bias dependence of the torques. But I don't calculate the bias dependence of the torque. I just assume it from, and then I send the reference to somebody's paper.
And then this kind of monodomain treatment, you think?
This is macrospin.
Yeah, but is it really reasonable? Like, let's say, how much?
Yeah, this is, okay, so this the parameters we put in here are really like, Mark can tell you. We assume there are reasonable parameters from these things. And this kind of calculation has been shown. I mean, we know from DMR data that you can actually explain at least these lines from, and all sorts of other things from, based on this type of calculation. There are things you cannot explain, but you can at least explain these parts here, the switching. Quantitatively, in the sense that you still assume saturation magnetization, damping factor, and other things. And this is, again, a zero. I mean, there's no finite temperature so far. If you want to introduce temperature and thermal activation, you have to introduce additional assumptions. So for the moment, we're just looking at the simple thing. And we imagine we can get rid of thermal activation. We go to low temperature. We do fast measurements. And we don't care about this for the moment. So then we end up with this phase diagram. So again, what this thing tells you, like I was showing on the experimental thing before, is that the parallel state is stable above this line. The antiparallel state is stable below this line. Here we find out that neither of them is stable. And here they are both allowed. That doesn't mean that there are not additional states that are allowed here. You just know that if the sample is in the parallel state, when it's here, it will stay in the parallel state unless you do something to it. So, okay. So the first thing you see is this weird curvature over here. So if you look at this, the way to look at these phase diagrams and to give you maybe a more intuitive understanding of this, is that if I want to measure a magnetoresistance loop without any spin torque terms in there, then I can take an infinitely small current. And what I do essentially is I scan along this line. So I go to zero bias, and I go along this line. So if I start with a sample in the parallel state, I'm going to sit in the parallel state until I get here. Here, the parallel state is not allowed anymore, so it goes to something, so I will see some switching. And then if I go on further, assuming there are no other states than the antiparallel state, the sample will stay in the antiparallel state no matter how much I increase the field. And this is because once I put the field to favor this configuration, if I assume the reference layer is not moving, it has to stay in the antiparallel state. And now if I go back, then nothing's going to happen until here. And here you switch to the parallel state, and then you stay in the parallel state. So this is really a square magnetoresistance loop, as you know from textbook. Now, if you start to apply an increasing voltage, either positive or negative, what you see, so this point here is zero voltage and zero K. This is the anisotropy, the easy axis anisotropy of my sample. This is plus HK, this is minus HK, and this, if I don't have any coupling fields, this loop is centered on zero. Now, if I start to increase the voltage, you can see that this transition shifts to lower applied fields, and this transition shifts to higher applied fields, no matter what sign I take for the voltage. And the reason for that is that the original assumption for this particular case was that the field like torque is quadratic on V and always favors the antiparallel state. So the more I increase, you know, this term here comes from the field-like torque. The more I increase the voltage, the more I favor the antiparallel state. So the less field I'm going to need to switch to the antiparallel state, but the more field I'm going to need to switch from the antiparallel state. Now, if you assume now, so this was, again, we calculated this also for other dependencies. So you can take, if you have an additional linear term for the field-like torque, this just shifts your parabola to some degree. And then you can also assume that if the field-like torque favors the parallel state, then you flip both of these parabolas to the other orientation. And if you then assume that in one case it favors the parallel state, and in the other it favors the anti-parallel state, then one stays like this and the other one goes the other way around. Okay. Okay, because again, we are experimentalists, this is how far we could be bothered to try to calculate something analytically. Please calculate the rest yourself and tell us what comes out. To make sure that we didn't make a mistake, again, because I need to calculate 5 times to get 2 coherent results, we also integrated this phase diagram. We also integrated the Landau-Lischitz-Gilbert equation with the same assumed parameters numerically. So what you see here is, first of all, that so this is starting, you assume the sample is starting in the parallel state, and you see what happens to it. And this is again where the sample is starting in the anti-parallel state and what happens to it. So you essentially, if you are in the parallel state, this is, remember, this is the yellow stuff is are the analytical critical lines. So this one was giving you the stability of the parallel state. So as we expect, if we are in the parallel state, we are going to stay in the parallel state as long as we don't cross this line. And if we are in the anti-parallel state, we start in the anti-parallel state, we're going to stay in the anti-parallel state and until we cross this other analytical line. Now, what you can see in addition is this color contrast in this area. So if you look at the time data, what the magnetization is doing in time, you can see that here you have steady state precession. Now, the other thing you can see, that applies here and here and also here and here. So this is, up is precession around the P state, AP state, and down is precession around the AP state. Now, what you see in addition to what we calculated before are these areas over here, which actually have been seen numerically before, but to my knowledge, nobody actually came up with a formula for this critical line, even for the metallic case. So what these areas here tell you is that, remember, the analytical calculation only tells you how far along your state is stable if you are in this state. So what happens here is that if I start from the parallel state, I do stay in the parallel state, which is what I calculate analytically, and this is what gives me this line here. However, if you start in the anti-parallel state, you're going to end up until you reach this black line over here, you're just going to have clamshell precession around the AP state. So if I make a scan now statically, so if I come from this point, starting from the anti-parallel state, and I somehow get into this area, and I do not increase the field or the current until I go beyond this line, and I just set them back to zero, the sample will go back into the anti-parallel state, because dynamic states are only sustained for as long as the current is passing through the sample. Okay? So we have these two additional areas over here. Now, so what are we going to measure, actually? So assuming this calculation is correct, what do we expect to come out of the measurement, still neglecting all sorts of thermal activation? So this is for off-pass measurements, because there's a lot of data available in the literature for off-pass measurements. Again, for the off-pulse measurement, what you do is you send some pulse through the sample, then you set the current back to zero, and you just use a really tiny current to determine the state of your sample, to measure the resistance. Okay? So that means if I start in the parallel state, until I cross this line here, I'm going to stay in the parallel state. So I can measure this line experimentally, even if it's offline, because off-pulse. So let's imagine we send this voltage pulse here with this amplitude. Then we set the voltage back to zero, and we measure the state of the sample. If I started in a parallel state here, the parallel state is still stable in here. So if I set the voltage back to zero, the sample will remain in the parallel state. Okay, so we can dictate this. But if I start from here, from the analytical calculation, I would expect that once I cross this line, I go to the anti-parallel state. However, you don't. Because if you make an off-pulse measurement, you come here, you cross this line, and you end up in some state which is clamshell or small angle precession around the P state. And then you set the voltage back to zero, and the sample goes back to the P state. It cannot cross the equator to switch to the other side. So what you measure is this line and this line. When you go to the antiparallel state, it gets even worse. So here, for the same reasons, I get this thing. However, I cannot measure this curvature. Because even if I apply this voltage here, so I start from the antiparallel state, the sample is in the antiparallel state, I apply 0.75 volt to the sample, I set the 0.75 volt pulse back to zero, I go down. What I detect is this state. And here, the antiparallel state is not stable anymore because the field has been, because the curvature is in this direction, and essentially, these fields here are above the anisotropy. So when the current is not there to keep it in the antiparallel state, it just goes back to the parallel state, which is the only state available when you detect it. So what you would measure is something that looks like this. So if I now plot this to see what should come out of the experiment, I get this thing which is rather either, depending on what you've done last night, it's either a fish or a pig or an elephant or something. So now what this tells you is that if I want to, so this is compared to the analytical phase diagram, still without thermal activation. So that means that if I want to fit anything from this phase diagram, which would give me any bias dependence, the only line I can use is this line here. Because for this one, I don't have a formula. For this one, I don't have a formula. And this one, I cannot measure with an off-pulse measurement. And,
what do you do experimentally to mitigate domain wall, multi-domain kind of behavior? Because I always assume that those things are very important for switching and kind of nonlinear dynamics.
Okay, so in this, for this experiment, you don't know how the sample switches. You just know if it has it switched from parallel to antiparallel or not. You don't care how it switches.
Pretty numerically, you know that it switches in a complex fashion, not as a macroscopic.
Yeah, but this you know experimentally, and you cannot. There's nothing you can do about it.
But that's what you assume, right? And kind of following this analysis.
If you want to take this into account, then you have to do micromagnetic simulations, and then this is
right, but
beyond our
looking at real experiments, not some kind of microscale simulations, right? Look, how can you just not worry about this domain wall issues?
Okay, so you don't. What has been seen and even imaged was that you go through inhomogeneous magnetic states, but then you don't really have a domain wall. I don't know anybody who has seen a domain wall in this case.
It's all in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, that's some, but it isn't homogeneous. That's the key thing, right? It's really not a macroscopic.
Yeah. But this is as much as we can analyze. I mean, everything else is like we cannot do more.
No, maybe you have some tricks to kind of mitigate those issues.
Oh, okay, good. So in this sense, you can do stuff. Like you can, for example, look at how, you can do time domain experiments. So you can see what happens there. You can do, you can image this thing like the Stanford guys did. You can, but to fit anything through the data, I mean, this becomes impossible to make a fit without a formula.
But there's no formula, right? So it's just too complicated.
Well, there's a formula for this thing. The question is, do we get something like this?
Let's see.
So if I take this plot I showed you before, because this was, so we started doing low temperature measurements, but so far we still have some problems with contacting the samples and so on and so forth. Now, this is the data from Kingin's paper. And now look at this blue thing here. And here's the fish flipped so that the tilt and current conventions are the same. So essentially, you get here, you get current and field favored in anti-parallel state, and here parallel state. So you have to, I mean, this the way you apply different positive fields and currents is always a convention. So here you have, I mean, it kind of looks like this. Here you have a straight line, which is this. Here you have something which is curved and with some path which looks more or less linear. So qualitatively, you can say, OK, it looks kind of like this. Of course, it can look like anything else you would want to consider. And in Kyung-jin's case, they took something else.
What about numbers, right? I mean,
yeah, OK, but I cannot. So this is just from literature. This is not my experiment. So this is now our experiment. And the question is, do we get this? But remember, so far we were unable to measure anything low temperature. I mean, we just got the first data, but we still have to do a lot of analysis. So, okay, we say, okay, let's just go to really short pulses, see what happens. So now these pulses are, of course, for the applied voltage. The fields are still DC, which means, I mean, switching in field is also thermally activated. So if you start with a sample in the parallel state, you get something like this. Which, if you are feeling generous, you could say, OK, there's a curvature and there's some kind of line. If you start with a sample in the antiparallel state, and again, you're feeling generous, you can say, OK, here's a straight line, which is what I would expect experimentally, and some other stuff on top and the bottom. And if I superimpose this on some kind of phase diagram, I get this. If I put both data together, I get this. Now, the first thing you see is that this switching field here in zero applied bias and this switching field here in zero applied bias are exactly the same. And this is a DC magnetoresistance curve. And this is because, again, in this experiment, these bits here are switching by field. Switching by voltage would be somewhere here. And the only thing which would change my switching fields on this MR loop would be the field-like torque. But the field, the applied field, the external applied field is still DC. So by the time I take my one data point here, which takes me some minutes, the thing has already switched to the antiparallel state simply because it's in an external field. And we cannot control the magnet at these time scales to do it with pulses also in the field. So we really need to go to low temperature to get anything that makes sense. Now, if I nevertheless try to fit a parabola through this curve, which I said it would be the one that might give me the field like torque, then I end up with something in field units, which is, again, what you measure directly without putting any additional assumptions in. You get something which is 0.5 millitesla per volt square. If I take the exact same data without converting it into a torquence from the thermally excited FMR curves measured on the same sample at room temperature, I get 7.25 millitesla per volt square. So there's an order of magnitude off. So one reason for that might be that, again, this here is thermally activated. So in principle, I'm trying to fit a room temperature thing with a 0K model. So that means that, so this is the room temperature coercivity, but my parabola should intersect the axis in the anisotropy field at zero applied bias. And the anisotropy is going to be way larger than the coercivity at room temperature. And we know this because we, even at 4 Kelvin, we get something like at least a factor of 10. So essentially, we're missing out on all this curvature because of thermally activated switching in the field. Hello. So I will still working on this low temperature stuff, which we have to do in a different group. We thought we can try to do some real-time switching experiments. This isn't going to get rid of the field-induced switching being affected by thermal activation. But if I monitor this real-time, what happens, I might possibly be able to measure this line, which is actually the switching in the voltage. Because here, if I'm here, I can tell the difference between the sample being in the parallel state or being in a precessional state if I make a real-time measurement. This always assuming that the signals are large enough. So we try to do this. So we have this pulse generator, which is what we used before. We can go to, I don't know, 100 or 200 picosecond pulses or whatever. We put these pulses through a power splitter, and one end goes to the 20 gigahertz real-time oscilloscope. The maximum sampling rate we can do is 20 picoseconds, so we can monitor the resistance in real time in these conditions. The other end goes to the sample, and because the sample is not impedance matched, there's some reflection here, and this signal goes back to the power splitter and in the oscilloscope, and then we can monitor the result over here. Now, this is again the sample which is reflected, the signal which is reflected from the sample, which is going to depend on the state in which the sample is, because the resistance of the anti-parallel state is something like 1.5 kilo-ohm. The resistance of the parallel state is 700 kilo-ohm. So you have a difference in there in this reflection coefficient. However, the difference between the anti-parallel and the parallel state, so if you want to see whether or not the sample was switching, then you have to look at really the top here, because on this I have superimposed this reflection of the pulse that I have sent to the sample as well. So here's how the data looks. In order to make the difference, and here's where you can see how small these signals really are compared to what, you know, the actual scale of the measurement. So what we do is we make a reference measurement in the P state, which we average 10 times because there's a little bit of lateral jitter in the signals as well. Then we take a reference measurement with a sample in the antiparallel state, which is the red line, and again we average it 10 times. And then here you can't really see it, but if you really stare hard, and I can show you the data, there's another green measurement, which is here, maybe you see a green spot. And this is the measurement for a given pulse, which was applied to the sample to see whether or not it has switched. And so by the eye, you can say, okay, this hasn't switched, it's all under this blue line. If you want to be a little bit more quantitative, what you can do is that you can take the measured signal and subtract it from this, and you can take the measured signal and subtract the parallel state resistance from it. So then you have this. So you can see that essentially this stays in the antiparallel state more or less until the end. If I just subtract the parallel state, this is a constant value. You can do the same in the other state, and here's finally a curve where you can see some switching. So you can see that you start off with a sample in one of the states, and then you cross to the other end, and you can also see this here. In the beginning, you're on the red line. At some point, you go down and here. And to make sure we don't have artifacts from this jitter on the time scale, we actually define the states by taking the last, I don't know how many points on this curve, and integrate over them just to make sure this is taken into account. Now, you can also plot the phase diagram, this phase diagram, or at least the switching events when you start from the parallel state, from this kind of real-time measurements, and then you get this thing here. Then again, here you still have not gotten rid of this thermal activation in the field switching. However, here you have recovered a more or less flat line, which you could attempt to fit according to the model. But if you want to fit it, you again need to know what the saturation magnetization is and what the damping is for this sample. So, yeah.
What actually do you do? White lines?
Oh, okay. So the pulse generator is set in dBs. So you have to convert it into voltages, so you can't really make regular steps. It's just a unit thing. So in the end, we are still waiting for the low temperature value, which hopefully are going to be more coherent and more in line with what we expect. We still have this one order of magnitude off between two sets of data, which could be related to the fact that these samples are so small and so thermally unstable that we are just at room temperature. Everything is just masked by thermally induced switching. We still have the spin torque FMR data to be analyzed. And there are so many fitting parameters that we have to somehow find a way to address initially, individually. And this is just by considering ways of estimating the impact of an electrical induced spin torque term. So now, if in addition to this you want to apply a thermal gradient, I'm not sure how you analyze the data at all. So I think, personally, I think, first of all, one, we had these tendencies for many years because maybe driven by applications. People always want to go to as low as possible switching voltages, so this gives you low MS and whatever. This also gives you thermal stability issues in exchange, and this is what we see here. But if you really want to do something quantitatively, you might be better off not by looking at switching events for which you need a really small device, but which you cannot characterize properly in the end. But you might be better off working with resonant techniques and looking at torques as perturbations in bigger devices, which are more stable and more homogeneous. And if this works out well, then you can consider applying a thermal gradient on top of it and try to quantify that, the thermal torques. But before, if you want to combine both to make sure that you actually measure something, you have to first know what your electrical torques are doing in there. Otherwise, you have to get rid of the electrical torques and find a way of measuring thermally induced torques without having electrical contact on your sample. So, this is it.
Plenty of time for discussion questions.
I have a comment about our data. In our case, we did not use post voltage.
Yes, you had you had 50 nanosecond pulses.
We showed two different data, and the phase error was obtained by applying the constant voltage and sweep the field, and we get RH curve and plot. So I don't think your straight line is not obtained with our methods.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood from the paper what it was, but.
And the other thing is the question. So you told that you have a large spin torque anomaly. So does it give reasonable statistics, or is it kind of random?
For spin torque FMR? Yeah, again, it depends on the field range. If you stay in the same field, I mean, at relatively low field ranges, it also gives you really low MS, which means, again, that your sample is not in a homogeneous state or is flipping around because of different reasons or whatever. You have to find, the thing with the spin torque FMR data is you have to find the parameter range where you measure something which is large enough to quantify, but it's also, I mean, you still have to normalize and subtract a lot of stuff from your output signals. So you have to play with the parameters a lot. I can't say. I mean, it takes weeks to analyze the data, so I can say some random thing, but when the data is analyzed, we can see. I can say it's shifting with the field. The signals are shifting with the field, which is good because otherwise it's not magnetic. So, and the shifts with the voltage seem to be really small. So this would agree with what you would get from this phase diagram, but other than that, to make it quantitative, I wouldn't want to.
I have a couple of general questions. So all this manometering parameters, all these different regimes, the behavior is more complex. Mm-hmm. And really designing your structures and performing this kind of sweeping experiments, are you motivated to somehow come up with a structure that will be really, really good for applications? Or somehow the main motivation here is to understand certain physical aspects?
I'm not really motivated by applications.
So it's just physics. But what is the physics that you're after?
Okay, so for in this
in this
particular case, there's a politically correct answer and there's also a real answer.
Wow, it's a real answer. Give us the real answer.
So the real answer was that I inherited a PhD student, which was more than 2 years into her PhD, still on maternity leave. So these 2 years without counting the maternity leave, and had absolutely no data. So we had to come up with a plan that gives us some kind of data with the stuff that we had, because, you know, we moved there, so we had to set up everything from scratch, all the measurements, but also the sample fabrication. I mean, now we make samples and so on. So the idea was to take all these things and try to come up with a, you know, just take the same sample and measure it through all, because people do either one or the other of these techniques on their samples, but the results are not necessarily in agreement. So, you know, the most reasonable thing you can think of is go and try the same stuff on the same sample, try all these things on the same sample and see what happens. At least this is a nice coherent set of data which allows you to say, okay, I have done all this on the same sample, I know it's the same sample, so I can draw some conclusions on it, rather than try to compare samples which have different compositions, different sizes, have been measured through different techniques, and so on and so forth. The other motivation was that, of course, again, for measuring this thermal torch, which was kind of the long-term plan for the next PhD student. A PhD student has to have a result at the end. So if you try to measure a thermal torque which is so low that you can never measure switching, the result is going to be, I have never seen switching. I don't know if there's a thermal torque in there. So experimentally, this is not viable. So you have to find either a technique in which you can measure things which are much smaller than what you would need to induce switching, for example, or to assist it by some ways and find a way to make the difference between the two. So one idea, for example, was to use the different angular dependence of the, you know, so if we accept that the electrical torques, damping light torques, have no angular dependence, then, and the thermal torques do have an angular dependence, then this would be a way, because you would see this on the phase diagram, right? So when you apply, you would see a change in the symmetry of your thing. But the point is, before you do that, you have to find a reliable way of quantifying these things. And you see that you're not measuring what you think you're measuring. Depending on how you make your measurement, it might be some other line which is not actually a critical line. It's really the switching line, which we don't know how to, I mean, I guess, for the GMR case, I think Thierry Vallet calculated these lines also from the bifurcation theory, but that stuff was never published in the end because he left Kokus, not Kokus, the other one, Grandis. So, and if you want to do this, I mean, I don't have enough theoretical background to start doing now bifurcation theory with an additional quadratic term in the equation.
So, like, what do you think are the questions for theorists, you know, the most interesting questions? So as you're designing your next generation, you know, experiments and calculations.
So I can tell you that the things which are easy to measure are these lines which I showed there. This is easy to measure because you can do it whatever.
What are the questions? What are the issues?
Okay, give me a formula for this.
For what?
For this.
Yeah, but that's kind of not somehow interesting.
Yeah, but if you give me a formula for this, then I can, and you give me a formula on how this stuff changes when you put an additional torque, a thermal torque in there, then I can actually make the difference between
it. What is it that you're trying to understand?
Well, so in the first round of thermal torques was that, okay, if you have 6K difference over the tunnel barrier, you can see switching. Now, first of all, we are not sure if we get 6K because we don't know how to estimate temperatures there. Really, and these torques might be much smaller when you take into account real interfaces and so on and so forth. So we may never be able to see switching induced purely by a thermal torque. Okay, so if I have to assist it with an electrical torque, I need to be able to tell the difference between the lines that come out and what I'm going to measure if I only have thermal torque. I mean, okay, if I only have electrical torques, or if I have electrical and thermal torques.
Let me defend it a different way, right? You don't really...
Oh, I'm not a deckhand, I'm just asking.
Let me defend it a different way. It is that you don't really understand something until you can measure it, right? And what she's showing here is that for these particular sets of samples, we can't make a quantitative comparison between theory and experiment. There's lots of good reasons for that.
For sure, yeah.
Right? And so what she would like to do is figure out a way to make that comparison. She can't run simulations of non-uniform samples at finite temperatures. You just go broke trying to do that, and that would be taking an experimentalist and making them into a modeler. So she would love to have, if you could give her an analytic form that she could use to fit for what the phase diagram looks like at finite temperatures, she would be in heaven.
For realistic situations, it's impossible, as you know.
So you're asking me to do it.
Guy like you?
Oh, it's impossible. If it's an homogeneous and nonlinear and all that, right, then it's kind of hopeless to do anything kind of detail.
But this stuff, okay, we're not even talking about the nonlinear regime. This stuff was even just assuming linear stuff. I mean, we don't even start considering nonlinear things. We cannot even, to be honest, I can show you sets of data, and I can, if you want, I can measure 50 samples on this particular set of samples, and they will give me the same parameters if I measure them in the same, you know, in the same conditions. And you would say, okay, this is a nice set of data. I'm going to put this, and I'm going to try to understand it. But the point is, you have to be aware of what you are measuring under the circumstances. And in all fairness, these samples are so sensitive to thermal effects and to local pill distributions and to all these things that this is, I mean, you can say, okay, this is, I have a nice statistics on the sample, it's beautiful, but if you really try to do it properly, you're going to see that this is not, I can keep you busy for another 5 years calculating this stuff if you want, but it's not going to fit reality.
Well, but anyway, it seems to me that somehow good questions still need to be formulated, right? Theoretical questions. It's not clear that there are good theoretical questions.
Okay, so if you...
For
if you,
complex, and
okay.
For sure, so theoretical questions, they just not good formulated yet.
Look, so if you just say thermal torque has an angular dependence, if you don't give me a formula for the angular dependence, I cannot fit anything. I can say, okay, there's an asymmetry between switching from P to AP or from AP to P, but these are you're going to make me try to draw a conclusion on 2 points in the data. And you see how this data changes. I mean, I cannot just, you see there are asymmetries for other sorts of reasons. You see, if I take this point here and this point here, they are asymmetric. But they are not asymmetric because I have anything thermal induced there. So this way, I cannot try to experimentally figure out something. I mean, I can, but I mean, who wants a conclusion drawn on 2 points? And you can do anything with 2 points. You can do anything. I show you. I mean, look at this data. Like,
I'm just wondering if it's possible to kind of break things down into simpler issues that could be somehow really addressed systematically, theoretically, not just like a matter of some kind of, you know, fluffy type theory, but like. You know.
For me,
so far, now it's too many things contributed together, basically.
Okay, so I can. So far, we can say, okay, we know where the problems are. We know what we can do to try to get rid of it and come up with a thing which is closer to what we think we are measuring. Okay, so you go to low temperature, you do on pulse measurements, you do all sorts of things which are a pain to do experimentally. So we can do this, and we understand we think we understand how to analyze this data once we have it. So we have a plan for this, for the electrical torques. Now, point B would be to introduce a thermal gradient. When I introduce a thermal gradient, you have to also realize that we know nothing about the interfaces. We know nothing about how all these parameters are going to change when I introduce a thermal gradient, especially since in Charles' paper, like in from one of the switchings, it was like you needed something like 50K over one nanometer barrier to change. I mean, if you change the temperature of the free layer with 50K, all these parameters are going to change. So you need to make the difference between experimentally, you need to be able to make the difference between just changing the temperature of the thing and having a temperature gradient and an additional torque. And in order to do this, you first have to start off with the easiest case, which is this. Right. And once you do this properly, then we can
suggestion go. Suggestion slash question. Is it possible to switch from this, I assume this are some kind of elliptical cells, I don't know, hundreds, I don't know if it's something. Is it possible to switch to, like, you know, uniform films? Because this is really, and then we're after some interface, some physics of the interfaces, right? Is it possible to really
go to
simpler, kind of more like a bulk type of?
How much current are you willing to pass?
Are you?
Start with linear response type of experiments and
again,
how much more about boundary conditions and things like that, which is all convoluted in, you know, in the pictures, right? Is there any hope to?
Okay, so again, look. Look, so for practical reasons, you can imagine measurements, and maybe we have an idea how to do it. But if the thing is like this, you have to remember not only in terms of how much current you need or temperature, but remember what you measure is TMR. Resistance times area is constant. Delta R times area is constant. If you make the area large, your signal goes smaller. When you go to these really small sizes.
How much can you know, go like the area to still be able to like, do linear response characterization?
Well, I would assume that if you only have a thermal gradient, and you can induce anything by thermal gradient alone. Well, it really depends on what is the signal you're measuring. How do you do your measurement?
I want to characterize the heterostructure as is, and not as a kind of device which switches over time, but first I just want to characterize this physics that takes place at the interface, especially once you turn on this thermal torques, right? I mean, the different physical contributions, there could be this kind of Seebeck type of effects, there could be Magnum drag effects. I mean, I just want to characterize the physics and this and heterostructures, and for me, the simplest starting point would be, you know, to just make this multi-layer, you know, laterally macroscopic, and then
linear response probes. This is what people do. They have an extended film. You put a platinum chip on it, and then you do spin pumping. So this is not.
To extract all the torques that develop the interface.
For a torque, you need a second layer. And what do you want to detect? So you need to change
the
so the thing is you need to
especially subjected to thermal gradients.
So what you need to do is you need to sit down and say, okay, I can measure a voltage that's this small. I can I can dissipate her heat from a current density that's this big, because you're passing current through this. So you have a square millimeter. You're passing current through that whole thing. Somehow you have to get all that current back out. And you have to sit down and you have to ask yourself, all right, how big a sample can I make?
Yeah, but that's how
it's not going to be significantly bigger than what
the really have
to. So in addition, okay.
That's how the experiments have to
be designed. But the point is, the samples aren't going to be that big. And when you get into that.
Well, microns would be enough. Just to the point that it becomes kind of sort of laterally macroscopic in a way.
Right, and then the magnetization is not going to be uniform.
That's fine. Subjected to external field and, you know, play with it.
So sit down with her and design an experiment, and she'll say no, you can't do that, and you'll say
first I will take a step back and ask what physics are we after, and then design the experiment based on that physics. You know.
So the physics you're after is, do we really have a predictive theory for any of this switching stuff?
So first.
I mean, even look, Yaroslav, from
torques. Yes. So that's one thing, and then torques is in the presence of temperature gradients. I mean, those things could be theoretically addressed. And those.
But these things have been. The problem is these things have been theoretically addressed. The thing is, people still have different opinions of what actually is the answer to it. And you cannot say, okay, I like my experiment best, okay, because it's my experiment and I sat on it for years and years and I had to analyze this stupid data and so on. Okay, so I would like my data to be right. But I'm not God, I'm not here to give you the absolute answer. I can only tell you what exactly you can quantify in this thing. And so far, I'm trying to find out a way of, at least for one specific structure, be able to unify at least the experimental results. And so far, we have not been able to produce a coherent set of data measured on the same set of samples through different methods which agrees with each other. And that's because there are all these issues which we typically just ignore. I mean, we just say, okay, it switched. But I mean, if you just look at, you look at this on-pulse switching, for example, how do you define switching? I mean, you see anti-parallel state is, you know, resistance changes with the bias, but this can be because of heating, it can be because it's gone into, it's gone off axis, it can be because it broke into domains, it can be because it's gone into inhomogeneous magnetic state, it can be because of anything. So the point is, you need to design an experiment and you need to you need to take your data and try to do the same in different conditions and see whether your assumptions that here is switching and here is not switching are still valid. And the only thing I can do for you as a theorist is to take my assumptions and my experiment and try to squeeze the hell out of them and see if they are wrong. And I can come here and say, okay, maybe they are wrong for this reason. But I cannot design a perfect sample. This is not, I mean, I can only tell you what the techniques are and what you can expect from these techniques. But if you just come then back to me with DFT calculations or ab initio calculations with perfect interfaces and temperature gradients at 50 Kelvin, I cannot do this experimentally.
All right, maybe we'll discuss.
So can you go to the slide 10? The first picture in the right side. Yes. The noise resistance seems does not occur at zero current. So what's the understanding about this?
Yes. Actually, it's coupling. So when you go to really, you can see this also if you, it's not even only on the... So first of all, you may have misalignments between the... So you assume that the easy axis of your free layer is exactly the same as the pinning axis of the reference layer in zero field and zero current. This may not be true. When you do your lithography, you can try to align your stuff so that the thing is pinned in the right direction, but in reality, you can always have some small distortions or who knows what. So you can always have some misalignment. On the other hand, you can also have coupling effects which make that if you go to low currents or low fields, the magnetization state becomes more inhomogeneous. Anything which is inhomogeneous is going to give me a higher resistance than the parallel state, the homogeneous parallel state, and also a lower resistance than the homogeneous anti-parallel state. And another reason why you can, for example, argue that the magnetization configuration of these samples is inhomogeneous when you go through these really low fields is that if you look at the magnetoresistance curve, now this is even without any applied bias. So if you look at the magnetoresistance curve, here I'm in the saturated state. Here I'm kind of in a saturated state and then it goes down and you can see, okay, now I start to rotate the reference layer, okay? But if you look at these ends here and here, you see that before the magnetization switches, it goes, it first gradually, there's some gradual change in the magnetization. So this, you either say, okay, it's starting to rotate, which means I have a misalignment, okay? Let's say I have a misalignment between the two axes. And you can still do this in the macro spin, or you can, if